deep, deep affection for Ireland. Those words of Joe Biden, President of the United States, form the Irish Examiner's headline. And there are pictures of himself and the Taoiseach Micheál Martin having their virtual meeting on St. Patrick's Day on the front pages of that paper, the Irish Times and the Irish Daily Mirror. Jim Watson of AFP, who provided the images, was present in the Oval Office. And in the Examiner and Mirror's photo, you can see the pre-delivered glass bowl of shamrock beside President Biden. In the Times photo, it is obscured by some other form of greenery. The first bilateral meeting between Mr. Martin and Mr. Biden was dominated by a renewed commitment to peace in the North, the fight against COVID-19, and the promise of a state visit here, writes Daniel McConnell in the Examiner. In the Times, Suzanne Lynch reports from Washington that President Biden underlined his strong support for the Belfast Agreement. But she says that while senior congressional figures have warned London about breaching the terms of the Brexit agreement, the White House struck a more cautious note, privately and publicly, yesterday. Before the virtual meeting of the two leaders, a senior official said the US would not take sides in the debate, she writes. The Irish Daily Star leads with a report that we may be able to enjoy summer holidays abroad this year under a new European Union travel certificate plan. Under the proposed scheme, those who are vaccinated or who have a negative COVID test will be allowed to travel within the bloc. Wish EU were here, says the headline. According to the Irish Daily Mail, the Taoiseach wants the EU to pull back from what the paper calls a war of words that has broken out between the President of the European Commission and Britain over the supply of COVID-19 vaccines. The Irish Independent's lead story is taken from the Lancet Medical Journal, which has published a study outlining how people over the age of 65 are at greater risk of catching COVID-19 a second time. The Irish Sun leads with the arrest of a man in Cheshire yesterday on suspicion of murder and indecent assault at the home of the TV presenter Michael Barrymore. But back to the St. Patrick's Day virtual Irish visit to Washington. Electronic life support keeps Washington traditions alive, says the headline in The Independent over a piece by Senan Maloney. The writer has some sympathy for the Taoiseach not having been able to travel. Trapped in government buildings while all his fellow citizens enjoyed the most spectacularly sunny day of the year so far, Micheál Martin delivered his Urbi et Orbi like a pious prisoner walled up in the Vatican, Maloney writes.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen warned yesterday about possible export restrictions if the EU goes on exporting vaccines and not getting promised supplies back.
All options are on the table. We are in the crisis of the century. And I'm not ruling out anything for now, because we have to make sure that Europeans are vaccinated as soon as possible.
And British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, in turn, accused the EU of brinksmanship as the war of words over vaccine supplies escalates.
Keeping trade and vital supplies of medical equipment or vaccines is critically important. We've all been arguing for this. We expect those assurances legal contracted supply to be respected. Frankly, I'm surprised we're having this conversation. It is normally what the UK and the EU team up with to object when other countries with less democratic regimes than our own engage in that kind of brinkmanship.
The UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab there. And later today, the European Medicines Agency will be giving its assessment of the safety of the AstraZeneca vaccine after a number of countries suspended its use last weekend. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, has more on all of this. Let's start with that EMA review into those unusual clotting events. They have already said, though, Tony, that the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks. So what more can they add today that will make members states change their mind about using this vaccine?
I think, Anya, they want to show that they have done everything that is possible and necessary to reassure people that the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe. And they have, on a number of occasions now, said that the evidence so far shows that the incidence of these blood clotting events seems to be no more than normal in what you would expect in the general population. But the problem is that some of these thromboembolic events, as they're called, are very rare, and for that reason, the general data that scientists can look at is quite small, so it's hard to make any definitive judgment about any causal link. So that's why they're bringing in a lot of experts in the field of thrombosis and blood clotting to see what exactly the risk is. But clearly, the EMA and the World Health Organization have signaled already on a number of occasions that the benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine far outweigh any potential risk associated with blood clotting. I mean, after all, it's clear that people are dying from coronavirus as well, whether or not a small number of people have died from blood clotting, which may have been what you would expect in the population anyway, even if there hadn't been a vaccination campaign.
And while we await what the medics have to say about all of that, talk to us more about this diplomatic war of words that's been going on over vaccine supplies. Ursula von der Leyen being pretty pointed about the UK not having an open road back to the EU on vaccines which are being exported from the EU.
Yeah, I mean, the temperature between both sides just shows no sign of lowering. And again, yesterday, this flared up when Ursula von der Leyen set out a clear warning that the EU could bring in further export controls if it was felt or perceived that those countries that produce vaccines, whereas they are receiving exports of vaccines from the EU, and she said that the EU has already exported 44 million doses to 33 countries. If those countries which produce vaccines and perhaps which don't need as many vaccines as European countries do, she could restrict, or the EU could restrict, exports of vaccines to those countries if they're not showing a reciprocal openness, as she would put it. But of course, in the British press, this was immediately seized upon and portrayed as the EU grabbing UK vaccines. So of course, this is not helping the already fractious relationship between both sides, including on issues like the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Yes, and Dominic Raab accusing the EU of brinksmanship on the vaccines, the kind of spat, he said, reserved for countries with less democratic regimes than the UK, and also having a go at the EU over the Good Friday Agreement on St. Patrick's Day. So not a lot of diplomacy going around there, is there, Tony?
No, I mean, this is part of a pattern that we've seen really since the beginning of January, and it usually brings in the issue of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the tensions on vaccine rollouts. And it's hard to see, you know, how you can avoid these kinds of flare-ups given the political sensitivity of both issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a sense, for Brexiteers, the success or the superiority of the vaccine rollout in the UK is a kind of vindication of Brexit, although the EU would say that there is absolutely no connection between the two things. But, you know, this is a testament to the very febrile nature of the relationship at this point in time. And there's no exit that I can see at this point that would get both sides back to a more even-handed chemistry.
The other issue, of course, coming from the Commission yesterday is this travel certificate plan. There's still a lot of uncertainty about how it would work. Is this likely to be more successful, do you think, Tony, than the traffic light system of last summer that never really got off the ground properly, did it?
Well, I think already member states are putting in place their own requirements for travel, and airlines put in their own requirements for travel. So in a sense, you know, there is a system by degrees being put in place that will provide people with credentials, if you like, to cross a border, showing that they have had a vaccine, showing that they have a negative COVID test. So what the European Commission proposed yesterday was a holistic system that would show in an integrated way if you've had a vaccine, if you have recovered from the virus, if you have a negative COVID test, in a platform that will be interoperable across the EU, so that member states who would develop their own systems for a vaccine certificate could plug into this EU-wide system, and that would ease travel and the flow of business and so on across the EU as the summer starts to open up.
And finally, Tony, we'll be hearing from the Commission's public health spokesperson later on in the programme. But, you know, given the problems with, you know, the delays in AstraZeneca supplies and a slowdown now too in the UK, even with all the rows about exports and imports, this target, this EU target of 70% of adults vaccinated by the end of the summer, is that still achievable?
Well, this was a point that Ursula von der Leyen made quite strongly yesterday. And of course, she acknowledged that the first quarter had been disastrous, really, in terms of targets not being met. But she did spell out in quite graphic detail what is coming on stream in the second quarter. So there will be 200 million doses from Pfizer-BioNTech in the second quarter. There will be 35 million doses from Moderna. There will be 70 million doses from AstraZeneca, although they were due to deliver 180 million doses in the second quarter. And then, of course, Johnson & Johnson will be available. They will have 55 million doses. And, of course, that's a one-shot vaccination. So when you add all those numbers up, they do start to mount up, you know, well over 300 million doses that should start to bring that target of 70% of adults by the end of the summer into some kind of realistic horizon. But again, targets, as we've seen, can be put off course, and, you know, the same production problems might still arise, but the Commission does feel a lot more confident now that the second quarter will be a lot more different from the first.
Tony Connolly, Europe editor, thank you very much indeed for that. The White House was illuminated in green last night to mark the St. Patrick's Day celebrations. It came at the end of a day of virtual engagements to mark our national holiday. The Taoiseach and the US President Joe Biden spoke for 1 hour and 20 minutes on topics including COVID-19, Brexit and the UN Security Council. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan was in the Oval Office and he's been telling me more about the St. Patrick's Day round of virtual engagements.
I think from the Irish government's perspective, the main goal yesterday was to replicate in as close a way as possible what a normal St. Patrick's Day would have looked like. I think the fear would have been that the virtual nature of all of this might in some way have downgraded the standing of the engagements, lessened that diplomatic impact. But I think in general, the Irish side would have been very, very pleased with how it all played out yesterday. It started in the morning with a one-on-one virtual meeting with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the Taoiseach. They discussed Brexit, immigration, E3 visas. Then we saw two separate engagements with the Vice President, Kamala Harris, and then we had the main event, the virtual meeting between the Taoiseach and President Biden. I was in the Oval Office as that meeting got underway. It was my fourth time doing that on a St. Patrick's Day, and this time was very, very different. There were far, far fewer people in the room. I was struck by the fact that the Oval Office actually appeared a lot bigger than I remembered it, because it was half empty on this occasion. Now, despite the fact that the two leaders were 3,000 miles apart, there was a closeness there. There was a connection. The TV monitor that Micheál Martin appeared on was sort of tilted at an angle towards the Shamrock Bowl. Joe Biden leaned into the Shamrock Bowl. It worked. They managed to pull it off. There was a warmth in the room, a lot of warm talk from Joe Biden about his Irish roots, his fond memories of visits to Ireland. Perhaps with another president, you mightn't have been able to pull this off in that way, and maybe there would have been some kind of a downgrading, but I suppose that was never going to happen when you had a president who is so proud of his Irish ancestry. Now, the meeting itself was quite long, an hour and 20 minutes. That is longer than usual for these meetings between US presidents and Taoiseach. Afterwards, it was described as incredibly warm, incredibly positive. And at the end of it, Joe Biden told Micheál Martin he was only a phone call away. Another thing that struck me yesterday was the amount of events. There seemed to be some kind of a Zoom call or a virtual engagement almost every hour yesterday. They were coming at you thick and fast, and Joe Biden was on many of them. And they had Irish links, and it was an opportunity for him to speak about his fondness for Ireland. So I suppose that's another element of the virtual nature of these things. It actually makes it easier to have events and engagements that can be put together rather quickly. The Irish politicians may not have been able to come to Washington yesterday, but I can tell you the city felt very Irish. The fountains outside the White House were dyed green early yesterday morning, and late last night, the White House itself was illuminated in green light.
And Brian, lots of topics for discussion across those meetings you're referring to. But of course, the big meeting between Taoiseach and President and the big issues. Let's talk about Brexit and its impact on Northern Ireland. That was down for discussion. But how did that element of the conversation go? And did the Irish side get the reassurances that they would want from the White House?
Well, certainly on the public front-facing on-camera moments in that big Oval Office meeting, Joe Biden expressed his strong support for the Good Friday Agreement. Now, the Irish side would, of course, have been expecting that. He has said this repeatedly in the past. Nonetheless, it would have been very welcome to have him say it again in such a high-profile setting. And, of course, we know that Taoiseach thanked him for his constant support of the Northern Ireland peace process. It was interesting as well to see yesterday that there was another virtual meeting, and this was between the Vice President, Kamala Harris, and the First and Deputy First Ministers of Northern Ireland. Joe Biden dropped in on that call as well, I think a sign of the importance that's being placed on Northern Ireland. There was a printed readout of that call afterwards, and we were told that the Biden administration conveyed their support for the Northern Ireland Protocol and encouraged leaders to continue working towards a forward-looking Northern Ireland. Amid this ongoing row between the EU and the UK over breaches of the Northern Ireland Protocol, the official readout of the meeting between the Taoiseach and the US President said that they called for the good faith implementation of international agreements designed to address the unique circumstances on the island of Ireland. So again, I think the Irish side would have been pleased to see this reiteration and this support for an international agreement that has been signed by two sides. Now, one of Joe Biden's top advisors on Europe is Dr. Amanda Sloat of the National Security Council. She was in yesterday's White House meetings. I spoke to her last night, and she told me that when it came to this current row that we see between the EU and the UK over the withdrawal agreement, the Biden administration would not be taking sides.
I think the side that the president is on is the side of the people of Northern Ireland. He has consistently made clear his support for the Good Friday Agreement. I think we recognize that the Northern Ireland Protocol is a legally binding agreement that was signed up to by the UK and the EU, and it is up to those two sides to find a way pragmatically to implement it and make it work for the people of Northern Ireland. Certainly is watching events that have been happening over the last couple of weeks and continues to reiterate that his priority is continued stability politically and economically in Northern Ireland. And as he has said, we need to ensure that the Good Friday Agreement does not become a casualty of Brexit.
And Brian, another major topic of conversation was around the COVID-19 vaccine supplies. Now, what did the two leaders discuss here? Was there a direct request from Ireland, from Micheál Martin, for additional supplies?
Well, in his press conference last night, after his meeting with the US president, the Taoiseach was asked directly if he did reach out and ask for additional vaccine supply to be shared by the US. On this, Micheál Martin pushed back against the idea that America was sitting on this huge stockpile of vaccines that it could share with the rest of the world. He said that President Biden had gone through in some detail his views on the crisis, adding that he was very anxious to get his people vaccinated as quickly as he possibly could. He's then said that by the summer, the US would have a clearer understanding of how its own vaccination program was progressing and therefore its capacity of whether or not it could help other countries with vaccine supply at that point. Now, again, I come back to this official readout, the statement that we got from the White House when the meeting was over. And on that readout, it said that the two leaders committed to working together to address the urgent need for delivery of COVID-19 vaccines.
And that's our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan. Obligodes a cholina, obligations to fulfil. And that phrase, delivered a squelga in the European Court of Justice yesterday, St Patrick's Day, means that the state has obligations on bilingual packaging that must be fulfilled under EU law, even if that package is simply for dog tablets. The case was brought by Paddy McLonagh, Assistant General Secretary of Conra na Gaeilge. He spoke to us first about his action back in January. Agus Murawitz Arisha Father, agus a sphere gnairi le the chas the courts Europach in ye, ach keicho tawachtuch ata an tarasha. How significant is this win?
Captain Gucci on Tavok the Onyx Gabu is Darrell of Ion, Oxford Lori Horik murders too. It's historic in the sense that it's the first case, but we're moving on from that. The really important bit is that the European Court of Justice has found in our favour, and that has said that the Irish government did not transpose EU directives correctly, or didn't, indeed in this case not at all, and that the court has ruled that they must now do that. And it's a very clear direction to the state to implement the EU directives, and in this case to ensure that packaging for animal medication is bilingual.
Mm-hmm. But new EU regulations, Pather, mean that from 2022 the state can choose either Irish or English on the packages. So is this a short-lived win?
It should not be. The new regulations, as you say, state that the Irish state can decide which or both languages, and that is the argument that we will be taking up strongly from now on, once we have this result with the Irish state and with the Department of Agriculture, that both languages be used. They would have to be brought in between now and the end of the year anyways under this directive from the European Court of Justice, and there is no reason why they cannot continue with that. It's completely within the remit of the state, and as I say, we'll be taking this up strongly now with the various, with the government departments and indeed with the Taoiseach. We feel that from the start this whole issue has been ridiculous, to put it mildly, that the directives giving people basic language rights was not implemented by our own country. I mean, it's the interesting thing arising from yesterday's case, that it is the EU Court of Justice giving language rights in Ireland, language rights that have been taken away by our own government, which is a completely ridiculous state of affairs.
Paddy McLonagh, Assistant General Secretary of Conra na Gaeilge, Gurumila Mahagat. Lahar Thresh Shakht.
First check on the business headlines with Adam Maguire.
Thanks, Mary. The US Federal Reserve has forecast growth there of 6.5% for this year. That's up from the 4.2% growth predicted just 3 months ago. The improved outlook comes on the back of a recently approved $1.9 trillion stimulus package and a faster vaccine rollout program in the US. However, the Fed did not signal any plans to increase interest rates in the near future. Vodafone is floating its European phone mast business this morning, which will generate around €2.3 billion for the firm. Shares in Vantage Towers are to debut in Frankfurt this morning, priced at €24 each. That's towards the lower end of the price range sought by the firm. Vantage Towers owns 82,000 phone towers across 10 countries, including 1,200 in Ireland. And there was a significant increase in the number of over 65s accessing online subscription services last year, according to a report by Deloitte Ireland. 43% of over 65s reported having access to at least one video subscription service in 2020. That's up from 27% in 2019. Finally, for now, the currencies, €1 buying you 85.6 pence sterling and $1 and 19.7 cents.
And it's been a cracking week so far for the Irish at Cheltenham. Des Cahill, we're greedy for more.
Yeah, it'd be hard to match yesterday, Mary. The dominance was so great. And we're going to look ahead to that. And if today is mouth-watering, so is the Champions League quarter-final draw, which takes place tomorrow. Chelsea and Bayern Munich, the last two teams to make it through to the quarter-finals last night. Chelsea won 2-0 at home to Atletico Madrid for a 3-0 aggregate win. Hakim Ziyech after 34 minutes and Emerson in stoppage time got the goals. Bayern's 2-1 win over Lazio gave them a 6-2 aggregate victory. So here's the mouth-watering lineup for the quarterfinals: Chelsea, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, Liverpool, Borussia Dortmund and Porto. 3 from England, 2 from Germany, 1 each from France, Spain and Portugal. Now, Chelsea have conceded just 2 goals since Thomas Tuchel took charge, and the new coach particularly pleased with the spirit within the squad as they advance to the last 8.
Very good performance, unbelievable effort. unbelievable team effort, like from the guys on the pitch, the guys on the bench, even the guys on the stands. So could really feel it that we totally wanted, and we go through deserved. It was a big win for us.
Yeah, everyone was involved, but you scored a fantastic breakaway goal, high speed counter attack, everything you wanted. And that's why you picked those three players we were discussing before the match.
Yeah, that we have the possibility also to hurt them maybe themselves on a counter attack. They tried to press us very high in the first half, but they opened up some spaces in the back of the midfield, and we could exploit it and score a fantastic goal that gave us a lot of confidence. After that, we had chances to even shortly after to make a second goal and decide it was not possible. So second half were many minutes where we also suffered, but we were ready to do what is necessary to do, and this is another top performance with a deserved win.
Now, in the English Championship, Norwich had their ninth win in a row, 2-0 away to Nottingham Forest, and they go 10 points clear at the top of the table. Tonight's action is in the Europa League. Manchester United are level at 1-1 as they go to AC Milan. Tottenham take a 2-goal lead to Zagreb. Rangers are level with Slavia Prague ahead of their home game, and Arsenal have a 3-1 lead against Olympiacos. Well, the Irish head into day three of the Cheltenham Racing Festival, as we said, full of confidence after completely dominating yesterday. Two-time Grand National winner Tiger Roll claimed a remarkable fifth Cheltenham Festival triumph with victory in the cross-country chase. Put the Kettle On took the Queen Mother Champion Chase as odds-on favourite Chacon Pursois finished third. Heaven Help Us won, and there were two more winners for Rachel Blackmore on the well-backed favourite Bob Olinger, and then Sir Gerhard in the bumper. Now, the Ryanair Chase and the Paddy Power Stayers Hurdle are the big draws today. Envoy LN, probably the hottest Irish favourite in the Marsh Novices Chase, but they'll be interested to see how the horses coped with the recent change of yard from Gordon Elliott's to Henry de Bromhead. Chatham Street Lad, one of the easiest winners ever of Cheltenham's big handicap chase in December, returns to the track in that opening race as a strong second string for Ireland behind favourite Envoy LN. Trainer Mick Winters famously rolled around the winner's enclosure that day in celebration, and like that afternoon, young Irish rider Dara O'Keefe will be on board.
Well, that was a great day, Cheltenham in the Caspier Ball Cup, like a handicap. He kind of, they kind of fancied him going over and stuff, but it's great for the owners, and obviously Michael Winters, he's a real character, and he was rolling around in the mud, and I'm sure he'd like to have another go rolling around the mud.
I'm sure he would. Well, Rupert Bell will join us live from Cheltenham later in the programme. Also later today, Irish rugby coach Andy Farrell names his team to play England in the final Six Nations game of the season, and three Irishmen compete for another big prize in golf's Honda Classic. Shane Lowry, Graeme McDowell and Padraig Harrington are all involved.
Harsh and unfair, that's how the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, Dermot Farrell, has described the current restrictions that limit attendances at funerals to just 10 mourners. He said denying close family members the right to attend the funeral of a loved one is tolerable only in the most extreme circumstances and for the shortest possible period. Archbishop Dermot Farrell, good morning and thank you for joining us.
Not at all. Good morning, Mary, and good morning to your listeners.
And you made your comments in your St. Patrick's Day homily. What are you asking of government now in relation to Catholic funerals and worship?
Well, I'm asking, first of all, I made those comments in the context of celebrating St. Patrick, and he was the person who brought the faith to Ireland. I was down in Ringsend Parish, where indeed Oliver Cromwell landed in Ireland, and Oliver Plunkett landed there as well. And for Catholics, faith is very much a constitutive part of their vision of reality. And for Catholics, that vision is much, it's corporate, it's communal reality. And what I'm thinking, when we look at the person, you can't just look at the physical dimensions of the person. You also have to look at their emotional well-being, which is essential. You have to look at the social, mental and spiritual needs of the person. That's all part of our faith. And we have to be able to express that faith because it's part of our emotional well-being, and that has to be done in some sense in a communal way, but also I was making the point in a safe way. Catholics are not foolish. They understand the importance of their health, understand the importance of safety. And when our churches were open, they were probably the safest place in this country. And I've talked to people, and people have contacted me regularly over since I came here to Dublin, and when I was in Kilkenny, about that they see the restrictions as being too rigid, and they see them as an extremely blunt instrument. And there are so many people that are not able to attend, you know, the funeral of a loved one that they've spent perhaps all their life with, brothers and sisters. You have a husband or wife dies, for example, and they have 5 or 6 children, and that person maybe has some brothers and sisters, and they find themselves being confronted with having to leave some of those people outside the door of the church, which is perhaps the safest place in this city. I take the church up the road from me here, you know, in Whitehall. It seats 1,500 people. Is somebody telling me that 10 people scattered around that church are a threat to each other?
But are you suggesting, Archbishop, that you should override public health advice and bring congregations together in larger numbers than is recommended? Because, as you know, it isn't just about the gathering within the church. It's about the travel and everything that surrounds that coming together, isn't it?
Yep. But Mary, as you know, the gatherings are taking place outside the church. They're taking place in the cemeteries. And in fact, if people were inside where they're actually physically distanced because of the structure of the church, it would be a safer environment for people. I go down to my shop or whatever to get my milk in the morning, and I have to wade my way through the aisles to get there. And when the cathedrals of commerce open, we'll see the amount of people that are congregating within those settings. And yet, what the Catholic people and people of all faiths find themselves locked out of worship when everything else in this country is open.
So are you saying then that the restrictions as you see it are being disregarded and that they should now be set aside for the church?
No, I'm not saying that the restrictions should be totally set aside. Nobody is saying that. But what I'm saying is that the current restrictions are far too rigid. They're far too blunt. They could be relaxed somewhat and people would still be safe. You know, if you take a church with 1,600 people, is it unfair that people from the local parish could go in there 2 to 3 meters distance? These places are sanitized almost to a medical standard by volunteers, as was proved when we opened the last time. So I'm saying to the government, you know, people's patience is running out, and that has been expressed to me day in and day out. With regard to the fact that they're not going to accept a situation where they are locked out of worship until we get to level 2.
So it isn't about...
And they're saying to me they have a constitutional right to worship. It's protected by the Constitution.
This isn't just about funerals, Archbishop.
No.
It's also ahead of Easter services, is it, that you're making this plea?
No, not necessarily. I'm talking about when we move off level 5. That's coming up, as you know. So I want the government, as we move off level 5, to respect the right of people to be able to assemble with all the safeguards in place. And I'm not talking about a free for all. I'm talking about a limited number of people who could attend their local parish church.
But are you suggesting that limited number of people that you're talking about in the church, when churches reopen, should be of the order of what? 50? 100?
Well, order of 50 worked the last time. You know, for some churches, there was a very good system of pods where you had a pod within the church. If you could have a second pod, but there had to be 4 meters apart, the pods, they had to be completely separate with separate entrances and separate exits.
But this won't happen ahead of the Easter celebrations.
It won't happen in the Republic of Ireland, but it is happening in the north of Ireland, and we have many parishes that are split across north and south. We've 5 dioceses that are split across the border. So some parishes up around the border area are going to find themselves with a church in the Republic of Ireland, with the churches closed and people locked out, and people, you know, a few yards up the road in the north of Ireland, the church is open for worship. And you look at Northern Ireland, for example. In Northern Ireland, the state did not close the churches. That decision to close the churches was taken by the churches themselves as a responsible thing to do, given the level of the virus.
In Northern Ireland, the Catholic bishops are talking about a very cautious return to public worship after the 26th
about.
Of March. I mean, they are still saying what they describe as the domestic churches of the living rooms will still be, I suppose, what would be recommended to people. Are you worried at all, though, Archbishop, that you might not have the support of your priests here? Many of your priests are older, and
older, but yet they would not have vaccinations as yet.
Yeah, I'm saying that some churches may decide not to open, and that will be their decision. Not all of them will open, but what I'm looking for is that we have the opportunity for those who want to open to open. We will indeed have some churches that may not open, and we've people who may decide not to go, but at least they can make that informed choice as to whether they want to go. Some people will not go back to church, and I understand that.
Apologies, Archbishop.
Their choice.
Okay, Archbishop Dermot Farrell, there we must leave it this morning. Thank you very much for joining us.
Now, the speed of the vaccine rollout in the UK has been a big boost for Boris Johnson and his government. But yesterday, the NHS warned of delays to vaccinating people under 50 due to a shortfall in supplies, while the EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, as we've been hearing, has been warning about a possible ban on exporting vaccines from the EU unless they start to flow into the bloc from the UK. John Rentoul is Chief Political Commentator with the London Independent, and he has more. First of all, John, do we know what's going on with this NHS announcement on the vaccine slowdown there in the UK?
Good morning. Yeah. Well, we only know what the NHS letter that was published last night says, which is that there is going to be a significant reduction in the number of vaccines through April. I mean, there's going to be a huge boost to the number of vaccines for the rest of March, which means that we will be able to give the first doses to all the over 50s by the 15th of April. That was the target. I mean, the government is now reaping the benefit of having set some fairly relaxed targets for the vaccine rollout, because they knew that the supply wouldn't be even, and so they quite sensibly didn't set targets that would make them look as if they were failing.
Do we know whether this is a consequence of the policy of not holding back second doses, or is it a problem with the supply of AstraZeneca, the production of it?
No, it appears to be a supply problem, although AstraZeneca, the company, did issue a statement saying that there was no change to their supply schedule, but there does seem to have been some communications mix up there. I mean, there's the suggestions in some of the papers this morning that AstraZeneca were expecting a large consignment of vaccines from India, and that hasn't happened. But generally, I think the rollout is going very well.
And that's, if you like, what's happening in terms of the vaccines themselves. But besides that, we have this diplomatic spat going on between Ursula von der Leyen and Dominic Raab yesterday over vaccine exports. And how do you read those developments?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, everybody says how terrible vaccine nationalism is. But I mean, it looks as if Ursula von der Leyen is the one who's actually engaging in vaccine nationalism. I mean, threatening to block exports of vaccines that the British have ordered from the EU doesn't sound like a good way to take the moral high ground. I mean, I think the EU is in real trouble. I mean, it's not really for me to comment on the EU's problems, but I mean, there does seem to be an inconsistency between a lot of countries in the EU suspending the AstraZeneca vaccine and then complaining that they can't get enough of it.
And we'll have more on both of those questions in our second hour. For the moment, John Rentoul of the London Independent, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland.
15% of Irish family firms cut jobs in the past year. That's three times the rate recorded across Europe. That's according to a new report by the STEP Project Global Consortium and KPMG, which also shows that two-thirds of family firms here saw revenues fall. Olivia Lynch is partner with KPMG Private Enterprise. She joins me now. Olivia, for context maybe to start, how significant a part of the Irish economy are family businesses?
Beyond today. Good question. Family businesses are really critical to the Irish economy. They're the economic, social bedrock, really, of Irish society. Stats from the CSO last year would have shown over 160,000 family businesses in Ireland, and they're responsible for over two-thirds of all businesses employing close to a million people. And from our survey as well, you could see that, you know, a huge amount of family businesses are larger employers in the country, with 68% of the Irish respondents employing over 200 people.
So they're a significant part of the economy, as you say. According to this report, they cut jobs at a far higher rate than those in Europe. Do we know why that was?
I suppose if you think about it, Irish family businesses, you know, are mostly in the hardest hit sectors: retail, food and agri, leisure, hospitality. So it's unsurprising to see those kind of reductions in revenue and, as you say, employment levels over three times more than the European peers. But importantly as well, in terms of how they dealt with that and how they dealt with the COVID impact, they reduced labour costs but also favoured furloughing over higher freezes or reducing pay as what happened in Europe. So that showed, I suppose, that various government measures that are being put in place, the wage subsidy schemes, etc., have been working. You know, they're a critical way to keep employment, to keep employers connected with employees, and hopefully as we come out of this crisis, you know, bring employment levels back up.
Another part of your survey looked at the cost-cutting side. Labour, of course, a massive area in terms of cutting costs last year. Planned investments also deferred by a lot of businesses. But just 8% of Irish respondents said that they cut high-level pay. Well, that seems quite low. Was it the same in other countries, and is there a reason why it was relatively low?
Yeah, it was similar in all countries, but importantly, when we delved into that question more, what was clear from an Irish perspective was that they looked at alternative ways to incentivise management and to pay employees, as opposed to just pay freezes and that. So I think clearly showing that Irish businesses are, I suppose, adaptable, willing to look at ways to try and make sure management are incentivised without having to just cut pay, but similar stats across the globe here.
What about the outlook then for the year ahead? Do we know what shape they're in for what's coming, and do they expect things to pick up at least as the year progresses?
Yeah, so what we would see as well in business and dealing with family businesses is that there is clear optimism out there. You know, family businesses have some unique characteristics, I think, that will help them lead Ireland's recovery. Things like, you know, a patient capital mindset, the involvement of multi-generational, having that experience of the older generation, but also the new generation, bringing things like digital solutions, diversification, bringing the ESG agenda onto the table as well. So what we're seeing with businesses is they're scaling, they're talking about expansion and diversifying again. And one thing about the pandemic that we hear and see from the survey is that there's been an unexpected benefit, I suppose, with the gift of time. So a slowdown in operations has given time to explore new products and markets, implement these digital solutions, focus on governance, succession and ownership structures. And I think all of these will come together to make Irish family businesses really part of Ireland's recovery.
Okay, Olivia Lynch, partner with KPMG Private Enterprise. Thank you very much for that. More business news in the next there. For now, it's back to you, Mary.
4 minutes to eight. Let's check on the weather with Siobhan Ryan at Met Éireann.
Thanks, Mary, and a very good morning now from Met Éireann. Well, with large blocking high dominating our weather, we're looking at ongoing settled conditions over the coming days. Not as sunny as it has been, however. In fact, sunshine will be fairly limited. So today, we've mostly overcast conditions overhead, with patchy mist, drizzle and fog mainly occurring this morning. That's before becoming confined largely to west and northwest coasts. A few pockets of sunshine possibly developing later. Highest temperatures will range 9 to 13 degrees, mildest further south, and that's in a light to moderate northerly breeze. Now, we'll be generally dry and overcast into tonight too, with further patchy drizzle along west and north coasts. Lowest temperatures of 4 to 7 degrees, coolest under clearer breaks in the southeast, and that's with mainly moderate northerly winds. And really little change for tomorrow Friday, with dry and mostly overcast skies. However, like today, some sunshine may break through. This is for southern coastal counties, and we're looking at a fairly similar temperature profile, with top temperatures ranging a fairly seasonal 9 to 12 or 13 degrees in a light to moderate northerly breeze. Now, temperatures will slip back a little over the weekend, with a mix of cloud and some sunny spells, chilly by night under clearer breaks. And whilst the weekend will bring ongoing dry conditions and calm conditions generally, a weak weather front will feed down patchy drizzle, mist and fog later Saturday and for a time early Sunday. Today then, in brief, well, very dull and grey today with patchy mist, drizzle and fog, most of this occurring through the morning. Overall dry though, with some sunshine possibly breaking through locally, and highest temperatures ranging a very seasonal 9 to 13 degrees that range north to south across Ireland in a light to moderate northerly breeze. That's all from me for the moment. A very good morning.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 18th of March. This is Morning Ireland with Vanya Lawler and Mary Wilson. The news in detail now with Tommy Meskell.
The European Medicines Agency will this afternoon give its verdict on whether or not the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine is safe to continue to use following its suspension by 13 member states, including Ireland, due to concerns about a possible link to blood clots in a small number of recipients. The EMA and the World Health Organization have already said the benefits of receiving the vaccine outweigh any potential risk. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly reports.
The suspension of the AstraZeneca vaccine is just the latest in a catalogue of setbacks and controversies surrounding the rollout of vaccinations in Europe. The EMA stepped in after 30 cases of unusual blood disorders were reported out of a population of 5 million people who'd received the vaccine. In particular, Europe's regulator is investigating any potential link between the vaccine and cerebral venous thrombosis, or CVT. In Germany, 7 people aged 20 to 50 were diagnosed with CVT within 16 days of receiving the jab. However, the EMA has already said this incidence would be the same in the general population, even with no vaccination programme. In other words, there may well be no causal link. The EMA's Irish director, Eimear Cook, has said the agency has carried out a rigorous science-based investigation, bringing in experts in the field of blood clotting and thromboembolic events. A formal endorsement of the vaccine should allow countries to resume the use of AstraZeneca doses, but the authorities will be concerned that it will have increased vaccine hesitancy in parts of the European population. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
In Britain, the health service is to suspend vaccination of people aged 49 and under due to a significant shortfall in vaccine supplies. In a letter to vaccination project leaders, NHS England has instructed them to prioritise giving existing recipients their second dose rather than extending coverage to new cohorts. Our London correspondent, Sean Whelan.
This is the first major setback for Britain's vaccination programme. Yesterday evening, the NHS alerted everyone involved in delivering vaccine doses to the public that there will be a significant supply shortage next month, just as the need to give people their second dose of the vaccine increases sharply. As a result, it has banned vaccinators from accepting bookings from anyone aged 49 or younger and ordered them to use the supplies they do get for people who have already had their first shot. The NHS said the shortfall was due to what it called reductions in national inbound vaccine supply. British media reports point the finger at AstraZeneca and production problems it is having at its European plants, which are also used to produce vaccines for the UK. Sean Whelan, RTE News, London.
The Northern Ireland Health Minister, Robin Swan, has said his officials are looking at what impact a reduced UK vaccine supply might have on the rollout. Mr. Swan said the programme was ahead of schedule and would be able to adapt to any changes as they arose. It's been announced that more than 300 Northern Ireland pharmacies are to assist with the COVID-19 vaccination programme. The North's Department of Health has set March 30th for the official launch of the initiative, but it expects many pharmacies will begin providing the service before then. Since the beginning of this week, those over 50 have been able to book a vaccine appointment. The Biden administration has said it's committed to addressing the threat posed by North Korea to regional peace. The remarks were made during a visit to South Korea by the US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. The authorities in North Korea have accused the US of adopting a lunatic theory about threats from Pyongyang, saying it would ignore attempts at dialogue by Washington unless it changed course. At a news conference in Seoul, Mr. Blinken declined to be drawn on the comments but stressed the commitment to regional stability by the US and its allies.
We're engaged in a comprehensive policy review, which we hope to complete in the weeks ahead, but what's significant about that review is it's being done in very close consultation with the Republic of Korea, with Japan, with other allies. We're focused on reducing the threat to the United States, to our allies, posed by North Korea's nuclear program, its missile programs, and to improving the lives of people.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 Weather with Centra. We're working hard to provide a safe environment so you can shop safely in your local Centra.
Overcast today with patchy mist, drizzle and fog mainly occurring early on before becoming largely confined to west and northwest coasts. Sunny spells breaking through locally, highest temperatures 9 to 13 degrees.
And here once again now with what it says in this morning's papers is John S. Doyle.
Deep, deep affection for Ireland. Those words of Joe Biden, President of the United States, form the Irish Examiner's lead headline. And there are pictures of himself and the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, having their virtual meeting on St. Patrick's Day on the front page of that paper, the Irish Times and the Irish Daily Mirror. The first bilateral meeting between the two men was dominated by a renewed commitment to peace in the north, the fight against COVID-19 and the promise of a state visit here, writes Daniel McConnell in The Examiner. In The Times, Suzanne Lynch reports from Washington that President Biden underlined his strong support for the Belfast Agreement. But she says that while senior congressional figures have warned London about breaching the terms of the Brexit Agreement, the White House struck a more cautious note, privately and publicly, yesterday. Before the virtual meeting of the two leaders, a senior official said the US would not take sides in the debate. Electronic life support keeps Washington traditions alive, says the headline in the Irish Independent, over a piece by Senan Maloney. The writer has some sympathy for the Taoiseach not having been able to travel. Trapped in government buildings while all his fellow citizens enjoyed the most spectacularly sunny day of the year so far, Micheál Martin delivered his urbi et orbi like a pious prisoner walled up in the Vatican, Maloney writes. The Independent's lead story is taken from the Lancet Medical Journal, which has published a study outlining how people over the age of 65 are at greater risk of catching COVID-19 a second time. One of the researchers is quoted as saying, "Our study confirms what a number of others appeared to suggest. Reinfection with COVID-19 is rare in younger, healthy people, but the elderly are at greater risk of catching it again." The Irish Sun leads with the arrest of a man in Cheshire yesterday on suspicion of murder and indecent assault at the home of the TV presenter Michael Barrymore. There is much coverage of the protest that took place in Dublin yesterday and a sense of relief that it was all relatively peaceful. There was barely a whimper, writes Michael Clifford in The Examiner. At the RTE headquarters in Donnybrook, he met one protester, Brian Dunn, who wore a red George's cross, elsewhere described as a Knights Templar outfit. When asked what he was at, Mr. Dunn replied, "Masks, social distancing, no man can rule another man under any guise." The Irish Daily Star's main story is that we may be able to enjoy summer holidays abroad this year under a new European Union travel certificate plan. The scheme would allow those who are vaccinated or who have a negative COVID test to travel within the bloc. "Wish EU were here," says the headline. The Irish Daily Mail reports that the Taoiseach wants the EU to pull back from what the paper calls a war of words that has broken out between the President of the European Commission and Britain over the supply of COVID-19 vaccines. The Times leader writer reckons it is time to reboot the relationship between Ireland and the UK. And to start the wooing process, there's a quotation from one of Shakespeare's sonnets. "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds."
Later today, the European Medicines Agency will announce its review of the safety of the AstraZeneca vaccine after a number of member states, including Ireland, suspended its rollout following reports of rare clotting events. As we've been hearing this morning as well, the UK and the EU are at loggerheads over AstraZeneca's distribution. So where does all of this leave the EU target of vaccinating 70% of us by the end of the summer? Is the EU still on course to do that? Well, Stefan de Keersmaeker is the public health spokesman for the Commission and he's been telling me why they still believe that target can be achieved.
I believe that is definitely the case. It is true that the first quarter has come with challenges and obstacles. But for the first quarter, we should have a delivery of 100 million doses. On the basis of our discussion with the companies, and it is going in that direction, we'll have 100 million doses. But there will be an important speeding up of the production of the deliveries in the second quarter. We expect in the second quarter almost 350 million doses. So including also Johnson & Johnson doses, of which you need only one vaccine to be vaccinated. Now, if you take all these figures together, we will be already very close to reaching the 70% by the end of the second quarter. We had set a target of 70% of vaccination of the adult population by the summer, and we believe that it should indeed be possible to reach this.
So when exactly is that target of 70% going to be reached? Are we talking about the end of August, the end of September, October?
Well, we had said by the summer. This is also not a quantum physics, of course. By the summer means in the course of the summer. Some member states may be in a position to be able to have vaccinated 70% already by the beginning of the summer, which is, of course, very good and which we would very much applaud. If a member state needs a little bit more time to reach the 70% and it would be more towards the end of the summer, then I believe that's also an important positive step. It's not that we have fixed a very specific date. We look at the period of the summer to take into account the situation of the different member states, which may have different epidemiological needs and a different state of vaccination.
It's just, you know, there has been, hasn't there, a bit of blows to people's confidence in the EU's vaccine rollout. We have the threatened export bans, the suspended rollout of AstraZeneca. We're expecting to hear from the European Medicines Agency later today. So lots of factors like that could, besides production difficulties in factories, that could mean you won't meet those targets.
First, as far as this AstraZeneca vaccine is concerned, we expect that the European Medicines Agency will make its conclusions on this vaccine today. So that will already clarify lots of things. Our point has always been that one of the things we have to do to reach the trust of the citizens is to follow a science-based approach. So we follow the science, we follow the scientific advice of EMA. That's one thing. Second, I believe that the figures that I have given you are figures on the basis of our ongoing discussions with the companies. We believe that these are realistic figures. So indeed, on the basis of these figures, it looks like we are really ahead will be able to reach the 70% target. We are aware that there were production issues, but let's not forget we have production issues mainly with AstraZeneca. With the other companies with whom we have concluded contracts, we do not have such production issues. BioNTech Pfizer is very much ahead of its production. Moderna works well. We have now Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which has been approved as well. So if you look at all of these elements together, we indeed believe that the 70% is realistic.
With or without AstraZeneca?
Well, as far as AstraZeneca is concerned, we expect 70 million doses from AstraZeneca in the second quarter. This is far less than what they had agreed on. But still, 70. If you add the 70 million to this second quarter, we would have 350 million doses. If we would not have AstraZeneca, we would still have almost close to 300 million doses, and we would still be on the right direction to reach the 70% target. Obviously, we stay in constant contact with the company, commission, member states and company to follow the deliveries, to make sure that the deliveries take place. But again, on the basis of how things are looking now, we believe that we are definitely on the right track.
The other issue I wanted to raise with you, Stefan de Keersmaeker, is some of the newspapers here are writing about digital certificate for travel plan, and the headlines are Jab Cert will let you go on sun holidays. Is that premature, or will we be able to have a sun holiday this summer because of these digital certificate plans?
Well, the idea of the digital certificate is that we indeed want to have first a trace of the medical situation of people, which would then help them to travel. That's the idea. And the idea is that we put it in place by the summer so that it can be used by the summer. The certificate would indicate the whether the person, the citizen, has been either vaccinated or whether it has had a negative test or whether it has antibodies as a result of an earlier infection. On this basis of this certificate, which would be recognized by all the member states, travel between the member states becomes again easier, which is, for instance, also important for the tourism sector, of course.
But even with vaccines, and as you were saying there, it could take the whole of the summer to get to that 70% level, even into the autumn. Is it safe, given the travel and tourism we learned last summer were associated with the second wave?
Listen, we have to continue following the epidemiological situation. We have to follow the rate of vaccination. Again, by the end of June, we believe that there will be sufficient, or all we will have sufficient numbers of vaccines to reach the target already by then, probably. Not yet, but we would be very close to reaching the 70% target already by the end of quarter two. We need to follow closely the epidemiological situation, that's for sure. Member states need to make sure that the vaccines that are delivered are indeed also used, quickly used for vaccination. This is going to be a common effort of all the member states. We're in this together, and we will look together with the member states to make sure that we indeed remain on track here.
And that was Stefan de Keersmaeker, spokesperson on public health for the European Commission.
And the Garda Representative Association will meet virtually with Minister for Justice Helen McEntee later today to discuss the ongoing COVID-19 restrictions, and members have a lot on their minds. Calls for frontline Gardaí to be prioritised alongside health workers for the COVID-19 vaccine. Policing authority concerns the pandemic is fraying relations between the force and the public, and COVID-19 protests, they're all on the agenda. Frank Thornton is President of the Garda Representative Association. He joins us now. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Mary.
And I know you sought this meeting with the minister after the violent protest on Grafton Street on the 27th of February, when one of your members said on our programme it was sheer luck that not more Gardaí were injured on the day. So what are you asking of the minister in your meeting today?
We are a year into the pandemic, and when the national vaccination plan was published, the low prioritisation of members shows, in our view, a complete lack of awareness to the roles and functions of Gardaí. Like, the nature of policing and our work requires unplanned close contact with members of the public, which we saw with the protests on Grafton Street. And very often we're in uncontrolled circumstances where the practice of social distancing is impossible. Like, look, I suppose 24 hours a day, like Gardaí, who are already working in an overstretched workforce, are facing into the unknown without protection against a deadly virus that could infect us and consequently our families and the public. The government and society have looked to Gardaí in this time of crisis, and we have consistently delivered. We've seen incredible demands placed on our members, and time again, we've stepped up to the plate and did what was asked of us unquestionably. And we feel now that, you know, we need to be vaccinated because of the exposure that we have every day during our duty.
And that is your number one issue in regard to your members. And where would you like to see An Garda Síochána put on the priority list? Our next group of people to be vaccinated will be those who are vulnerable.
We've always said, and I've always said in any statement, that, you know, the most vulnerable in society and the HSC workers are without doubt, and with valid reason, you know, the number one priority. But we believe, because of our close contact with both groupings, that we are very close to the priority after that. You know, we have a ridiculous situation that, you know, on a daily basis, we enter into A&E departments and hospitals, we enter into nursing homes where there might be sudden deaths, going into environments that are supposed to be, you know, and are now at this stage, vaccinated and clear of COVID, and we're completely exposing those to when we're not vaccinated.
Could you arrive at a point where, or do you find at the moment, a resistance among members to carrying out certain tasks?
No, like, it's a frustration. It's completely different. You know, we're a disciplined force and we follow direction. But the frustration on the ground with the frontline members, which is, you know, a few weeks ago, our own commissioner just told us to wait our turn, you know, that was received very poorly by frontline Gardaí, who were facing into, you know, a responsive role as regards policing the pandemic on top of our ordinary daily duties.
What about the report from the policing authority? We heard Bob Collins yesterday talking about what they see as maybe a fraying of that relationship now between the public and members of An Garda Síochána Síochána. Are you seeing that fraying of relations, and is that being reported to you by members?
Yeah, it absolutely, look, it is a fact, and I think we're all weary of the restrictions now. As I said, you know, we're a year into it, and there's no doubt, you know, the entire population is aware of it, and we're Gardaí, we're no different to anybody else. It has impacted on our lives and our families' lives, and that is reflected in the manner which, too, that, you know, we have policed this pandemic. We approach the police of this very understanding and compassionate and in a proportionate manner, like, you know. But despite any awareness that the people are experiencing, the members that we represent have managed to maintain that support to the vast majority of the public, who continue to work with us and act responsibly. And it's a credit to, I suppose, the professionalism that we hold on the front line, that so few interactions with the public have been confrontational or led to an escalation of enforcement.
There's been a significant number of fixed penalty notices issued, and the majority of them, I see from the policing authority report, issued in the 18 to 25-year-olds. Are you seeing a fraying, and Limerick, your own area, one of the areas that is very high in those numbers, have you seen that fraying in that age group among the student population? We've seen the you know, student residential areas and partying going on.
Yeah, look, we do, and I suppose again it's born out of frustration with the restrictions, and just by their meaning, it just restricts movement and preventing citizens from congregating or socializing. So it is an inevitable factor of restrictions.
So what then is your message to the minister today? Is it ease up on restrictions, minister?
No, our message is a clear awareness of the health and safety of members in the frontline, and an awareness as to the roles that we do, which seems to be lacking, because it makes no sense and there is no logic to our low prioritisation.
All right, Frank Thornton there, President of the Garda Representative Association.
Now, Irish farmers say compulsory quarantine of people arriving in Ireland to work picking fruit puts an extra cost on an already overburdened industry. This comes as government is working to revive the Help to Harvest scheme, which attracted very few workers from Ireland to pick fruit last season. And it also follows a letter from the Minister for Agriculture to the horticulture sector, highlighting the need to follow COVID-19 restrictions, quarantine and guidelines. Cian McCormack reports.
When you're picking fruit, Cian, you have 24 hours to pick it and you have 24 hours to sell it.
Jimmy Kearns owns Kearns Fruit Farm outside Enniscorthy in County Wexford.
If you don't pick it on the day, it's gone soft and you can do nothing with it. That's how stressful it is.
He grows mostly strawberries and raspberries, and picking starts soon.
We start usually around the 1st of April into about the 20th of November. We'd be picking near a million plants here now.
Picking all those plants depends on mostly foreign workers.
By the middle of May, we'd be in full production. We'd have about 75 to 80 people here. Probably 90% of them would be all Bulgarians, Romanian and Polish.
Last year, Jimmy, who's also the IFA's soft fruit chairman, brought in workers from abroad before the first lockdown.
Eight people from Bulgaria who started here in January last year. That eight people were here, and then once COVID happened, we were afraid. And we tried to work out as well as we could and use the people that was available to us.
This meant Jimmy turned to social media to get Irish workers.
We placed ads on Facebook and things like that, and we got people from Mayo and Galway and places like that.
When restrictions relaxed at the end of June, the Irish workers went back to the sectors they originally worked in.
Things started to open up again in the country, and hotels started to open. A lot of the people that were picking fruit for me went back to their local jobs. I was short people in August and September and October. And on the back of that, I lost a lot of fruit. Couldn't pick it.
So what happened?
Well, it just rotted. And there was a lot of fruit that we had to dispose of.
In a letter seen by this programme, the Department of Agriculture has written to the IFA and the horticulture industry, emphasising
the need to source workers in Ireland. It also outlines quarantining procedures that need to be followed by producers like Jimmy. Here's an extract from that letter.
We encourage, in the first instance, engagement with the local labour market and with the services of the Department of Social Protection to fill vacancies given the significant number of people currently seeking work in our economy. It's important to note that essential workers are permitted to travel from abroad, but importantly, must observe strict public health protocols.
Jimmy Kearns says the public health measures are needed, but they place an extra cost on an already stretched industry.
The hiring of foreign people at the moment, it's very costly. But what do people do? You're caught between a rock and a hard place. We have to pay their wages while they're isolating. Do you understand me? The same thing would apply in a hotel, if they're in a hotel.
Last year, Keelings in Dublin flew 189 workers from Bulgaria to Ireland to pick fruit. This year, like other companies, it will again depend on foreign workers. In a written statement to Morning Ireland, it said the following.
Keelings needs to recruit approximately 850 seasonal horticultural workers. Keelings' policy is to always advertise and recruit locally in Ireland for these seasonal workers. However, a significant majority are required to be recruited from outside of Ireland.
Last year, government ran the Help to Harvest campaign to get workers from the live register to work on fruit farms. According to a Freedom of Information application by the journal.ie, 34 people were offered positions as of early June 2020. 16 were accepted. The Department of Social Protection told this programme it's not in a position to verify placements from the scheme. However, the department confirmed it's trying to revive Help to Harvest again this year.
The department is working with the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine to provide a streamlined, efficient approach this year once there are sufficient numbers of employers interested in engaging with us on the scheme.
Jimmy Kearns didn't get anyone from Help to Harvest last year, but he still supports it.
We got plenty of people calling, looking for work, but nobody turned up when we offered them the jobs. We'd support any scheme that can get people to work. The problem is, Keane, that our social welfare system is very good here in Ireland. And a lot of Irish people look upon picking fruit as beneath them.
And while government pieces together Help to Harvest 2021, Jimmy Kearns doesn't want to see a repeat of last year. You're facing what happened at the end of your season last year, where you're looking at 2 months of fruit essentially being thrown out because you can't get anyone to pick it.
Exactly, yeah. We're totally relying now this year on foreign labour. And what really hurts growers or anybody that's producing to see their crop lost, it's like losing somebody belonging to you. It was devastating for me last year to see that kind of volume of fruit go to waste and we're struggling to survive.
And that was Jimmy Kearns, who's the IFA's National Soft Fruit Chairman and the owner of Kearns Fruit Farm in Enniscorthy in County Wexford, ending Cian McCormack's report.
The owner of Aer Lingus issued 2 bonds worth €1 billion as it seeks to further boost its balance sheet. It's the first time IAG has issued bonds as a junk-rated borrower after the impact of the pandemic saw its investment status downgraded last year. The bonds are set to list on the Euronext Dublin and will mature in 2025 and 2029. Major stock markets have jumped overnight and into this morning after the Federal Reserve significantly upgraded its forecast for US growth. It's now predicting growth of 6.5% this year. That's up from the 4.2% growth predicted just 3 months ago. The improved outlook comes on the back of a recently approved $1.9 trillion stimulus package and a faster vaccine rollout program in the country. At shares in Vodafone's phone mast business, Vantage Towers are to debut in Frankfurt this morning, priced at €24 each. That's towards the lower end of the price range sought by the firm, and it raises around €2.3 billion. Vantage Towers owns 82,000 phone towers across 10 countries, including 1,200 in Ireland. Finally, for now, the currency is €1 buying you 85.6 pence sterling and $1 and 19.5 cents.
23 minutes to 9 now, and Des Cahill is here with all the latest in sports news. Cheltenham, Des?
Indeed, the Irish heading into day 3, Áine, of the Cheltenham Racing Festival, full of confidence after completely dominating yesterday an incredible six Irish winners, including two-time Grand National winner Tiger Roll, claiming a remarkable fifth Cheltenham Festival triumph. That's only been done twice before. Put the Kettle On took the Queen Mother Champion Chase as odds on favourite Chacon Pursois finished third. A great result for Aidan Coleman and trainer Henry de Bromhead. Heaven Help Us won for Richie Condon and trainer Paul Hennessy, who only has two horses in training. And two more winners for the fantastic Rachel Blackmore on the well-backed favourite Bob Olinger, and then Sir Gerhard in the bumper. There was a poignant element to Sir Gerhard's victory, the horse bred by a young Kilkenny man, Jonathan Fitzpatrick, who died in a car crash at the age of 23. Jonathan, having bred Sir Gerhard, sold for €17,000. Now, Sir Gerhard subsequently was bought for €400,000 by Cheveley Park, so his great victory yesterday must have been an emotional time for the Fitzpatrick family. What a wonderful legacy. Rupert Bell joins us now live from Cheltenham. A nice story about Sir Gerhard, part of an Irish avalanche. And what about Tiger Roll, Rupert?
Yes, well, Cheltenham just does throw up emotional stories, dramatic stories, and that is one of them, the sort of the heartstring pulled by that story. But also Tiger Roll, once again, he is the most popular horse in training, this little horse with the biggest of hearts. We'd written him off coming in to the cross-country race. Many people had. He'd been pulled out of the Grand National. But I think his performance yesterday was probably the best of his five victories. Easy's Land is no mug at this cross-country game, and he made him look like a second-rate horse yesterday. It's just such a shame that the O'Learys decided to pull him out of the Grand National, and we're going to miss the chance of him trying to emulate the Great Red Rum, which on the evidence and talking to the British handicapper yesterday, he'd have a mighty chance on all known evidence of doing. But it won't happen. It's such a shame.
You think they should have left him in?
Absolutely. And then if the horse had run badly, then you could say, and no one would have thought differently and said, look, he hasn't been running well this year. Yes, he's 11 now. He owes nobody anything. Off he goes and has a lovely retirement. But looking at the way his enthusiasm, I was commentating on the race and I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. This was the Tiger Roll that we've come to know. We hadn't seen really for the last sort of, you know, he was disappointing in the race last year. But this was the old Tiger Roll, and I think it is a shame. But, you know, we can't look back now. The decision has been made, and a new champion will be crowned at Aintree on April the 10th.
Right. Now, today, Envoy Alain, I suppose, is the hottest Irish favourite.
Absolutely. In the same colours as Sir Gerhard, the Cheveley Park owners. Of course, it's now with Henry de Bromhead, but Jack Kennedy retains the ride. 11 straight wins, three from three over fences. I think there's one punter who's got a lot of expectations on this horse. If this one wins, he comes away for a £5 bet with £500,000. So he will be hoping Envoy Alain continues the Irish dominance. I think we all do, because so far we have seen the real hot shots deliver in spades, and Envoy Alain, looking at the opposition, should be good enough to win, and hopefully the transition from to Henry de Bromhead's yard hasn't had any impact, but he's got the same groom with him and everything, so fingers crossed Envoy Alain does put his best foot forward.
And what else should we watch out for today, finally?
Well, Min's trying to win the Ryanair Chase for a second year running. May struggle. I don't think he's quite as good as he was last year. And then we've got the Stayers Hurdle. And I'm desperately keen to see a little bit of British success here, because it's tough. As you completely dominate. But I hope Paisley Park runs a big race and can regain his Stayers Hurdle crown. But whatever, I think this week racing has got back on the front foot with the stories on the track.
Great stuff. Okay, Rupert Bell, thank you very much. Last night's Champions League games, and Chelsea and Bayern Munich through to the quarterfinals. Chelsea's remarkable form under new coach Thomas Tuchel continues. They've conceded just two goals in 13 matches since he took charge. Last night they won 2-0 at home to the Spanish league leaders Atletico Madrid for a 3-0 aggregate victory. Hakim Ziyech and Emerson got their goals. Bayern had a 2-1 win over Lazio, gave them a 6-2 aggregate victory. So the eight teams in tomorrow's quarterfinal draw, what a fantastic lineup. It's Chelsea, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, Liverpool, Borussia Dortmund and Porto. In the English Championship, Norwich won again 9 games in a row. They won 2-0 at Nottingham Forest. They're 10 points clear at the top. Tonight's action is in the Europa League. Manchester United are level at 1-1 as they go to AC Milan. Tottenham take a 2-goal lead to Zagreb. Rangers level with Slavia Prague ahead of their home game, and Arsenal have a 3-1 lead against Olympiacos. Later today, Irish rugby coach Andy Farrell will name his team to play England in the final Six Nations game of the season. And finally, for now, three Irishmen compete for another big prize fund in golf's Honda Classic: Shane Lowry, Graham McDowell and Padraig Harrington, all involved.
A dark day for the beautiful game. That's how The Guardian's David Conn describes the long-awaited Sheldon report into historical sexual abuse of children in English football between 1970 and 2005. The FA has apologised, as the report found significant institutional failings in the FA and that the association hadn't done enough to keep children safe. One victim, Derek Bell, told officials at Newcastle in 1997 that he was abused by George Ormond, who'd links to the youth team, although never directly employed by Newcastle. Mr. Bell told the BBC how he later confronted Ormond at his house.
One morning I went down to his house, obviously I knew where he lived, and I had a tape recorder in my pocket, and I asked him some pertinent questions. You know, why did he feel the need to abuse me? But he just couldn't. At that time, he did say, you know, yes, he did admit to doing it.
And that was survivor Derek Bell. Guardian journalist David Conn has been telling me more about this long-awaited Sheldon report into historical abuse in English football.
Yes, well, the Sheldon review, Clive Sheldon, QC, a barrister, was commissioned shortly after the victims began to speak out, following an interview that one of them, Andy Woodward, did in The Guardian in 2016. So the Football Association commissioned Clive Sheldon to report on essentially how it happened or how it was allowed to happen, and who knew what at the time, and who and if more could have been done to prevent it. And there's a big inquiry that he's made into the circumstances at particular clubs where particular now notorious sexual abusers, some of whom have post-2016 had very, very new prosecutions and very long prison sentences. What happened at those particular clubs where they worked? But overall, he's painting a picture of a landscape in a sport, and actually not just in football, in other sports and more widely in society, mm-hmm. where there just was not adequate child protection, adequate safeguarding. And he's painting a picture of the vulnerability that young people are placed in for predatory sexual abusers, where, in my view, he's painting a picture of a sport that was wide open to it.
And this review runs to 710 pages. It looks at 8 clubs. There are 692 survivors, 240 suspects. The scale of it is, as you say, it's a dark day for the beautiful game. And big questions too for the FA, for those responsible for the children's safety, about what could have been done sooner to protect them.
Yeah, and the FA is the governing body of football. And Sheldon recognises that after 2000, particularly, football, along with other sports, in conjunction with the NSPCC, did overhaul child protection, and they did bring in modern safeguarding, modern child protection. He says that between 1995 and 2000, they were too slow to do it. But pre 1995, and his report covers a period from 1970, but some of these abusers were clearly operating before that. Some of them go back into the 60s. And he's essentially saying there was no child protection policy. There was just playing football and adults in positions using their common sense. And one thing, he says all they really had to do was to use their common sense. And for me, it's a screaming documentation of why you need policies and safeguards in place. And he says, that there was a lot of naivety and ignorance about it, and that abusers are very cunning, they're very manipulative. They all, in their different ways, were charismatic individuals. They all appear to have been good at coaching, good at the job. So they worked their way into these positions, and then they had, well, unrestricted access to young boys, to teenage boys.
The FA has apologised. What happens in terms of Sheldon recommendations? What happens next?
Well, Sheldon has made some recommendations for further improvements, but it is widely recognised, and I think it is important for people to understand that we're not looking at anything like the scenario, I think at any level of sport, that there was in the 1980s and up to the mid-1990s. I mean, one of these abusers, Roper, who operated at Blackpool, who was the person who abused Paul Stewart, had three criminal convictions for child, I think they called it interfering with a minor, in the early 1960s, but there was no system of any football club making a criminal record check, which is now the most basic thing that you have to fill in for working with children across any range of activities, not just sport, in this country. So it's recognising that there is a modern safeguarding system, and actually it's true that the football system and the Football Association and the Premier League and the EFL's systems are actually held up as very high standards now. But he's making some further recommendations for improvement, and some of the survivors have been a little dismissive of that and said, well, you know, it's not exactly rocket science, and you could have made these recommendations in 2016. You didn't need to wait for 4 years for a QC to make them, because they're just common sense that you should keep improving.
David Kahn of The Guardian on the Sheldon report. And just a reminder for anyone who may have been affected by the issues raised in that interview, the 1 in 4 helpline number is 0800 121 7114. The Samaritans free phone 116 123.
Now, today is D-Day for the AstraZeneca vaccine. The European Medicines Agency will give its verdict on the jab, which has been suspended in a number of countries, including Ireland, following safety concerns. The EMA has already said it was unlikely that the reported adverse events were connected to the vaccine, and the World Health Organization also recommended that vaccinations continue. Luke O'Neill is Professor of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College. Hello, Luke.
Hello, Mary. How's it going?
And I know from the get-go you felt that the vaccination programme with AstraZeneca should not be stalled. But do you expect the green light today from the EMA for vaccinations to resume?
We do, Mary. In the grand phrase, we're cautiously optimistic, let's put it that way, you know, because they've made very clear statements. They said they were firmly convinced the benefits outweighed the risk. That was a couple of days ago, you know. WHO says the same thing. And then yesterday, COVAX, which is a massive organization for vaccination, they say the benefits outweigh the risk. So we can wait now. We're waiting as ever, but I expect them to give it the green light.
And would you think you might see terms and conditions applying, you know, that there could be some further actions or restrictions around the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine?
But the worst is that they will say there's a link, but it's extremely rare. And the rarity means we must keep using the vaccine. That's one possibility if they find some kind of a link, which, we, as I say, that we expect them not to. But there's still a chance of that. You know, they might say take low-dose aspirin if you're in a high-risk group of blood clotting, you see, as a precautionary principle. You know, again, that phrase. But still, I think it'll be given the green light, possibly with a couple of extra lines, just to reassure. It's all about reassuring people anyway. And on the one hand, it's not too bad that there's a bit of caution here, but sadly, of course, they've gone too far with holding it. I mean, I would have just followed the EMA's guidelines from the start, which said keep using the vaccine while we check these reported events, you see.
Now, if they put some conditions around the vaccines or some warnings, as you say, of a potential link at some stage, is that likely then to feed into vaccine hesitancy? And even if they don't do that, given that we've had the programme stalled, will that feed into a vaccine hesitancy where people say, maybe I'll have a vaccine, but I won't have the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Exactly, and that was a huge reason not to do this, because previous situations, we know, for example, the HPV vaccine was stalled in Japan, and when they reintroduced it, nobody would take it. You know, so there's evidence if you show any kind of hesitancy with vaccines, it gives rise to much increased level of caution. And there was a survey last week, you may have seen it, on Clare Byrne, 38% have said now they're anxious about this vaccine. So that's the downside. That means we need a big information campaign to remind people this is a very efficacious vaccine, 100% protection against severe disease and death, you see. But you're right, that's the big concern, that people won't want to take AstraZeneca.
And you'll have seen a report in today's Irish Independent about a study that I think is reported in The Lancet, which suggests that older people, people over 65, are far more likely to contract COVID a second time than people in the younger age cohort. So this will be worrying again, given that, again, AstraZeneca for a time was not being recommended for the over 65s.
Exactly, yeah, and it wasn't too bad. The over 65s, there was a 47% protection against reinfection, which isn't too bad. You know, the under 65s, 80% decreased risk of reinfection. So you're right, the older people are slightly more at risk of reinfection than younger people, but still show some protection. But this makes it even more important to vaccinate that age cohort. As we know, the over 65 should be protected as much as possible because of those kinds of features.
What would you say to people who would have some hesitancy now? Maybe not, you know, they're not anti-vax, but they have some hesitancy now, given all that has happened around the AstraZeneca vaccine. What would you say to them?
It's very understandable. Let's start with that, Mary. I mean, AstraZeneca have hardly covered themselves in glory, have they? You know, but we've got to remind them the data is very compelling with that vaccine. As I say, 100% protection against severe disease and death. I mean, you know, that's the bottom line from this vaccine, really. And equally protects against infection, too, and also is stopping transmission. Remember, it's been in 24 million people now, that vaccine, and there was nothing to be worried about from that massive study, and then showing great efficacy. The UK, the numbers are looking great. I mean, big protection in the over 80s because of AstraZeneca, you see. So I guess all we can do is remind people of the good side of this, which far outweighs the bad.
Just want to ask you as well, we're still in level 5. We expect further announcements as we come into the first week of April about where we go from here. But at the same time, Luke, we're now seeing some plateauing in the numbers, even maybe a slight increase in the positivity rate at the moment. And I think maybe a growing fatigue with restrictions, perhaps an increasing clamour for an easing of restrictions. How does public health walk the line and avoid us ending up back where we were at Christmas?
Yeah, the concern now is this new UK variant, which is obviously spreading more all over Europe. You know, it's more transmissible, as we know by now. So that's probably part of the reason why things are plateauing. In other words, you need to double down on all the measures to really fight the new one that's a bit more transmissible. But I do think, Mary, they'll have to give us some relief, because it can't go on the way it is. People's mental health, as we know, is in trouble here. You could open up certain things that you know are relatively safe, you see. And again, we need an effort to say we're going to do this because we think this is a relatively safe thing to do, you see. So we're all hopeful there'll be one or two loosenings, shall we call them, on the 5th of April, and then we move on into April and May. And as we know, the vaccine is the way out, you know, hence it's such important to get this thing right, you see.
Okay. Professor Luke O'Neill, thank you for your time this morning. 2 minutes to 9.